One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasurer.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just...
G'day and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast that takes the big economic issues and explains them in plain English. I'm Jennifer Macy, producer of Follow the Money, and I'll be filling in for host Ebony Bennett while she's on leave. Today, we're bringing you a conversation from the Australia Institute's popular webinar series. This time, it was independent Senate candidate for the ACT, David Pocock, who was in conversation with Executive Director Ben Oquist about the election results and what comes next in the Senate. This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 25th of May, 2022, and some things have changed since recording.
Well, what an election result. Those of you who join us for our fortnightly poll position, we'll know that last week, Pete Lewis of Essential Media, based on the Guardian Essential poll, called a Labor majority of 67 or 77, maybe as high as 83. And I tipped a hung parliament because I thought at least one or two of the independents would get up in the lower house. So I was out by quite a lot, as it turns out. But what we saw on Saturday night was no doubt absolutely huge for Australian politics and for the country. There was a real collapse of the Liberal vote around the country, particularly in its heartland seats. We now have a Labor government, obviously, led by Anthony Albanese. And the big story of the night was obviously the green slide in Queensland and the so-called teal bath, as I think one Liberal commentator called it on Saturday night. There's six community independents winning seats from the Liberals in Sydney and Melbourne, joining what will be an enormous crossbench. And of course, a lot of people forget about the Senate, but not here at the Australia Institute. And the next Senate is likely to see Greens and Labor have a blocking majority. The Greens will have 12 in total in the Senate. And of course, here in Canberra, on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country, independent Senate candidate David Pocock looks set to take the second Senate seat from Liberal Zed Seselja. So thank you so much for joining us today, David Pocock. David, having migrated from Zimbabwe with his family as a teenager, went on to captain the Wallabies, as many of you I'm sure will know, and vice captain the Brumbies here in Canberra as part of a stellar rugby career. He's been awarded for leadership on and off the field. He has a master's in sustainable agriculture and a track record as a powerful advocate on issues ranging from climate to marriage equality. He's involved in multiple small businesses and co-founded numerous not-for-profit community initiatives in Australia and overseas, including with his wife, Emma. We're so glad that you could join us today, David. And now I'm going to hand over to Ben Oquist, our executive director and resident Senate expert, to really unpack the results from the election. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Ebony. And thanks to everybody for joining us. It's lovely to be here in Canberra with Canberra resident David Pocock to unpack what happened and what might come next. We're really glad you've come into the studio here, David. How good is Canberra?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a big few days, big few months, but yeah, really energising getting out and talking to so many Canberrans, seeing just how much we love our city and want better for the way that we're represented.
Mm. This result's put Canberra on the political map. It tends to not count politically at federal elections, that's for sure. There's often an argument that you need people from major parties to deliver for Canberra, but on the other hand, it's often taken for granted here in Canberra. What did you find most resonated with the Canberra residents during your campaign?
I think a lot of people do feel like we're being taken for granted by both major parties. It's such a safe and has been for forever.
Mm.
And so actually having an independent voice in the Senate who can go into bat for for the ACT on issues that are important to us and doesn't have to toe a party line that's been designed to win votes in Queensland and WA and Tassie. There are a lot of challenges we're facing here in the ACT that, I think a lot of people are frustrated with the lack of voice on them and the lack of action.
And you went to the election with a broad suite of policies, from cost of living to climate change. Did you think the issues changed through the course of the campaign, that people were more concerned about something at the beginning than the end? Did it build in one direction?
It seemed like as the election went on, particularly the coalition realised that cost of living and housing affordability are huge issues.
Yep.
And, Canberra is in a housing crisis. We're right at the forefront of this. We're the most expensive place to rent, second most expensive to buy. And all this talk of Canberra having the highest average income, I think glosses over huge number of people doing it really tough. It's not working for us. Mm. And so this is going to take a sustained effort, some really big picture thinking, and I think some bold moves from this next government to start to deal with it.
Yeah. And have you had discussions yet with the incoming government about what they might do on housing, or have you seen policies from them that might work?
Well, I haven't declared victory.
Sorry, David.
We're still waiting on the count. The Senate's soldier to concede.
Yeah.
So we'll wait and see. But I haven't had any of those discussions yet.
What's something that a new incoming government could start to do on housing to get us going, do you reckon?
I think one thing would be to look at the social housing debt that the ACT government has. We're set to spend $33 million over the next decade just on interest repayments. Tasmania and South Australia had their debts wiped. And we've got a huge shortfall of social housing here in the ACT. I think there's a really strong case for that as a starting point.
Mm.
During the campaign, talked a lot about a national housing strategy, which Labor have committed to.
Mm.
And then it's actually backing in the short term a lot of initiatives here in the ACT, like Homeground, that are incentivizing landlords to create more affordable rentals. If you rent your house out at 25% or more below market rate, then you don't pay land tax.
Mm.
So we need a whole suite of interventions to actually start to deal with this.
Yeah, interesting. Well, perhaps we'll come back to housing at some point. I know we'll have a lot of questions from our audience in the second half. We're going to spend a little bit of time unpacking a variety of things that happened in the campaign and things that might happen going forward. And David's, of course, being modest, as he should be, about whether he's won the seat or not. Our analysis and a lot of other people says that you will. It also says that probably, as Ebony mentioned, the Greens will have 12 seats, Labor probably 26, which gets to 38. And, of course, as Senate number crunchers know, you need 39 to pass legislation in the Senate. Of course, the incoming government can sometimes rely upon the opposition to pass legislation. But when the opposition opposes, even if the Greens are on board, they'll need one other vote in the Senate if those numbers play out as we expect and Labor doesn't pick up a third seat in South Australia or Victoria. What would be your approach to handling balance of power in the Senate?
I've said the whole way through my campaign, my commitment to people in the ACT is to look at each piece of legislation and say, how will this affect people in the ACT? How does this square with the kind of future we want in Australia? But also to bring a really constructive and pragmatic approach to actually getting things done. Talking to people across the ACT, one of the big frustrations with politics over the last however long, and I think we saw that in the outcome for independence and the swing away from major parties, is the frustration with the politicisation of issues that, frankly, Australians just want leaders to get on with dealing things around climate, housing, women's safety. These should not be issues that governments and the opposition use to score points. It should be, how do we actually solve these problems? And sure, there's different ideas on how to do that, but we've got to get on with actually solving them.
Mm. And do you think there are ways of reforming how the parliament works to make this change that you want? I mean, you're advocating there a kind of pragmatic approach. to getting things done. Have we got some institutional barriers in the way that Parliament operates that prevent that you think we could tackle?
Well, we saw, the Jenkins Review, respected work stuff, like that's a bare minimum.
Yep.
Reading through that, that's nothing groundbreaking. That's just actually lifting the standard up there to what you'd expect in most workplaces across Australia. So that's clearly a starting point. But, you know, talking to people, when you watch Question Time, you expect to actually watch some constructive dialogue debating the big issues. I don't think that's what we're seeing at the moment. So I think there's a real sense from Australians that we can do things better. And, you know, watching it from the outside, it seems like a lot of non-career politicians and independents are the ones who can actually talk about the issues that resonate, that matter to the people that they represent. And that's my hope and sort of my commitment to Canberrans is I'll be in there advocating on those issues for us.
Yep. One of the things that infected the election campaign was some pretty grubby tactics from all sides at certain points. And it's related to fixing up how Parliament works. Are there things that you think we can do, we can learn from how the election campaign was conducted that we should fix?
Integrity Commission has to be a priority. The vast majority of Australians want it. I think we saw that reflected in the result.
Yep.
But I think truth in political advertising, you know, I've been signing your open letters for years calling for federal truth in political advertising legislation. Australians expect it. It shouldn't be on the voter every election to have to wade through all the lies and nonsense. It's done at a state and territory level. We can clearly do that federally.
Do you think that's something that the crossbenchers might work together on with a new government, try and get passed pretty quickly in time for the next election?
I'd really hope so. Mm. You know, I think almost all the independents are backing it. The member for Warringah has already put forward a Stop the Lies bill. So this is clearly something that Australians want to see happen. And we saw it this most recent election. I was targeted with a sort of fear campaign. Other independents were actually targeted by Labor with a very similar campaign trying to, you know, paint her as a Liberal candidate. So clearly we need to do work in this area. It's inconvenient for the major parties, but it's what the community wants. So we should get on with it.
Yeah. While we're here, Eb, a lot of ideas about how to reform our democracy and make it better for the 47th Parliament. And I'm going to give a copy to David while he's here. It outlines the case for truth and political advertising, but plenty of other good ideas there as well. So delve into that. David, I did want to come to the issue of climate change. We were discussing just before we went on air here how it was only after the election that the pundits, the media, everybody is kind of rightly declaring it the climate election, where it wasn't being called that for the election, but clearly it had a big impact on voters. What's your take about how there was a misread about how important climate change was?
I certainly think climate was part of it. I don't think it was the only thing. You know, we've heard a lot about the Green slide, but there were more independents elected than Greens members. So I think it was much more than that. And it was tied to integrity and women's safety and people just feeling like they're not actually getting the representation that they deserve, that politicians aren't getting on with actually looking forward and solving these big problems in a way that turns them into opportunities. Mm. When it comes to climate, there's clearly been a societal shift on this. We know that we have to play our part in the international community and we have to play our part in the Pacific. It is, as someone who's spent, you know, the last 15 years in rugby teams where half of the squad has a Pacifica heritage, we have to be doing more. You can't talk about the Pacific family if you're not leading on climate change, because this is an existential threat for many of these nations. So, you know, I certainly think it's to do with that, but it's also about the shifting economics when it comes to climate. Australians know that we're missing out on opportunities now, both in terms of building an economy for the future, but also household savings. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work coming out showing that there are really meaningful savings at a household level. You know, on average, $3,000 to $5,000 per household per year. You compare that to a six-month fuel excise cut or $150 in your bank account, you can't compare the two. So this is a massive opportunity for us and something that I think will and should be a priority for the next parliament.
Mm. How important was that a reframing of the climate change message to your campaign, in the sense of we had that big cost of living kind of crisis take over the election campaign narrative at some point, and as you've mentioned, undoubtedly genuinely felt by the community. For so long we've heard about the costs involved in taking climate action. How important was that kind of rewiring Australia, electrify everything message in reframing the debate for you and your campaign?
Mm-hmm. I mean, Saul Griffith and his team done amazing work, not just on digging down into the modelling in detail, but I think also telling a more compelling story about our future and what it can be. And I think that's been a real failure when it comes to climate, of trying to paint that more hopeful picture and ensuring that we are talking about people in regional areas who, you know, very rightly have concerns about this. Their livelihoods, what they've done for generations, is being threatened. We've got to find ways to talk about it in a way that is giving them a better future. And I think we're finally starting to get there. We've left it very late and there's a lot of catching up to do, but it is such a huge opportunity for us here in Australia. Mm. And, you know, going up to COP26 last year in Glasgow was such a reminder of just how out of step we are with the international community, but also with our key trading partners. And so, you know, I think this next parliament is an opportunity to actually get meaningful action and things in place that take us from dead last to actually leading.
Mm. I mean, Labor's got some policies in this area, you know, some policies in the electrification, rewiring Australia space. Do you think there are specific things that they could move further on in that area?
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I've sort of been thinking about it is there's two sort of broad parts about it. There's the decarbonising part in terms of generation and industries, but then there's the household level piece. And I'm determined to ensure that savings go to households. Rooftop solar in Australia is a raging success, an incredible what was started by John Howard. And we can do the same thing that we did for rooftop solar, for heat pumps, for batteries, for electric vehicles, and unlock really meaningful savings. During my campaign, I proposed a Suburb Zero pilot here in Canberra, which would then actually prove that you can do this and help inform policy that does that, and then roll that out across the ACT, across Australia. And, you know, the modelling looks like for $12 billion over 5 years, which is a lot of money, but it's also just a tiny bit more than we subsidise fossil fuels this financial year. So this is about priorities. This is about actually creating the future that we want here in Australia.
Mm. We'll stick with climate for a little bit longer before coming to some other issues and before coming to everybody else's questions, which I know are flying in. Climate integrity has been bubbling up as an issue, in particular in relation to Australia's carbon markets. And there's a lot of focus on increasing Australia's target to get in line with the science. As I heard you say on Radio National this morning, the Business Council of Australia even has higher targets than both sides of politics at the moment. Mm-hmm. But it's also important that the targets are actually met with genuine abatement and genuine emissions reductions. The incoming Labor government has promised a review of the Emissions Reduction Fund and Australia's carbon market. What's your view about what should be done in that space?
We've heard so much talk about investing in technology. The reality is that we already have the technology to get on with, you know, reducing a big, big chunk of emissions. Sure, technology will play a part, but it's clear that the millions, you know, billions of dollars sunk into carbon capture and storage, you know, the recent concerns around sort of carbon trading schemes in Australia, it all needs a good review, and integrity has to be central to it. If we're genuine about actually solving this problem, then the actions we take have to be good bang for buck. We should be paying taxpayer money on things that are genuinely going to make a difference. Mm. And, you know, coming from a farming background, I think something, part of the debate that we have to reframe is that farmers and land managers have a really important role to play in this. Half of Australia is managed by farmers. So we have to ensure that we're working with them. We're not villainizing farmers, but we're incentivizing them and rewarding them for actually looking after, you know, this amazing continent that we live on.
Mm. Mm. Good. I come to a couple of other issues, if we can. You've been a strong advocate of territory rights. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do to overcome Canberra's, you know, second-rate status as not being able to legislate for euthanasia? In the middle of the campaign, New South Wales became the final state to pass laws, the voluntary assisted dying laws, after a push from Alex Greenwich, independent MP, and number of other MPs. It is an issue that seems to be that independents have taken forward, broad community support for the issue of voluntary euthanasia. But I guess then there's this separate democratic issue about whether Canberra is allowed to have debate on it. What practically can you do, and how quickly, to try and get that Kevin Andrews bill overturned that was passed, you know, 25 years ago?
This is clearly an issue that's really important to Canberrans. I've committed to introducing a private senator's bill as soon as I can, really prioritising that. And I guess, you know, voluntary assisted dying as an issue aside, looking at this in terms of equity, it makes no sense that people who live in the territories don't have the same rights as states to debate and legislate on these issues that affect us. It's not going to cost the government anything to give us that right. And I'd really hope that there is broad support for the territories being given that right back to actually decide on these things. As you said, the majority of states now have legislation. And, you know, thanks to the Australian for the great work you've done in actually surveying Australians. 76% of Australians living in states support the territory's rights to have this. So, you know, this has broad support any way you look at it.
Do you think it was instrumental in the poor showing of the Liberals here and ZSLDR in particular? You had the Canberra Times joining the campaign to get territory rights. How much of a factor do you think it's been in, I know you don't want to claim victory, in Zed's demise?
I think it was certainly a real frustration amongst a number of Liberal voters that on this issue, Senator Selger chose to put his personal view above the territory's right to actually be able to debate and legislate as a territory. So we had a number of people involved in our campaign who had voted Liberal all their life, but were frustrated with the ideology rather than actually being in there to advocate on behalf of the people you represent.
Mm. Well, speaking of Canberra and its rights, what do you think about how Canberra is discussed publicly from time to time? And I'm taken by that phrase that Scott Morrison really electrified, the Canberra bubble. Mm. And Canberra's positioning, sometimes in the political debate, the public services positioning sometimes in the public debate, and federal government in one of the last acts of the previous government announced a new efficiency dividend for the public service. What do you think about Canberra's status in the national debate, public services positioning, and what can be done about that?
Yeah, really disappointing to see in the budget flagging further decentralisation of public service, and then obviously during the election campaign flagging further cuts. We have to be valuing public service. For me, the debate should be less about how big or small it should be, but about the quality and ensuring that it can deliver for Australia. We saw during COVID the value of having a good public service. It's crucial and allows us to, you know, have what we have here in Australia. So I would love to see a lot more value placed on it, the way we talk about it, at a time now where we've got a serious task to actually rebuild trust in government and our institutions, and we need it more than ever. So there's no quick fixes to this, but I think over the next few years, I think we can continue to value and invest in our public service and really talk about it in a different way. Talk about the value that it actually provides all Australians.
What about the Prime Minister and where he lives? Mm-hmm. What can we do about that? And how important do you think that might be?
Canberra's the capital of Australia. I'd love to see the Prime Minister actually live here. You know, this was something that came up in the campaign a lot with the nation's capital. Take the convention centre as an example. It's the second oldest convention centre in the country. It can't actually hold a major convention. We've got the ANU taking big meetings to Sydney. There's no real pride from government in the nation's capital, and I think we need to be investing in our national institutions and ensuring that it is viewed and as the nation's capital and the important role that it does for all of us.
I'll put it on. Will you ask the Prime Minister to come and live in Canberra full time in the lodge?
that's up to him, but I think it does send a powerful signal to Australia that you're serious, you're here to do business. And I think, to his credit, it was really impressive to see how quickly him and his core team were sworn in and off to the Quad meetings. I think it sends a really good signal to Australians and to the rest of the world that Australia does want to be more constructive and contribute internationally.
Mm. One last leading question on Canberra and its pride. We're a bit of a Canberra fan club here at the Australian Institute, being based here, so it's nice to have a senator talking positively about it. One last thing that maybe connects those two issues is you mentioned that it was good to see the new Prime Minister being sworn in so quickly and off to the Quad and talking about climate change. One of the things that was discussed as he went over there was, I'm going to put you on the spot here, David, was Australia hosting a COP. Mm-hmm. And that Albanese might be, the incoming Labor government has promised to try and bid for one. You mentioned being over there in Glasgow, and it was nice to spend a bit of time with you there myself, but being impressed by the COP and being embarrassed about where Australia stood. What do you think about Australia hosting a COP, and what do you think about Canberra hosting that COP, and what do we need to do to make that happen?
I'd be supportive. I think it would signal a real change in direction in terms of the Pacific and actually ensuring that we're leading. You know, we should be standing up for Pacific Island nations on climate. They look to us for leadership, and it's no surprise that we've seen what's happening with the Solomon Islands. We have to up our diplomacy, we have to up our support, and we have to up our leadership on climate. So I think it could be a really powerful thing to announce that we're back and we're going to be part of solving this problem. I mean, climate change is personal for a lot of Australians now. You think back to the bushfires here in Canberra, the worst air quality in the world, straight into 2 years of a global pandemic. I think we'd had enough time to actually process those bushfires. And then we've seen, floods up north, fires in WA. We've had warning after warning from the IPCC. We just need the political will now to actually get on with doing what leaders should be doing, is dealing with problems.
Mm. And can we ask the government to host the COP in Canberra? We've got the facilities.
I don't think at the moment, which is a real shame.
Mm.
The business community in Canberra has been banging on about a fit for purpose convention centre for over a decade.
Mm.
Every year they turn away $20 to $25 million worth of business just because it's too small.
Mm.
It could be great for Canberra to actually invest in something like that that can not only hold international showpiece events like a COP, but also host government conferences and cybersecurity. There's so many great industries here in Canberra that I think would make use of a facility like that.
I'm going to ask a couple more questions before we throw to the back to Ebony and get her to get us into what the audience wants to ask you. But a couple of more personal questions. David, when did you decide to run for the Senate, and how different or similar was the campaign to what you anticipated? What was the kind of surprise or what you didn't expect from where you started to where you ended up?
Yeah. So early last year, a group called PROACT formed, which was really modelled off the Voices Vindi group, and they started looking for an independent Senate candidate. So I had a number of people throughout last year hassling me, saying, we really believe there's a pathway for an independent in the Senate and the ACT. It's never been done before, but it is possible. Would you consider it? I was working on a conservation and agriculture project in Zimbabwe and, you know, thought about it, but didn't think it was something I wanted to do. I guess as time went on, I thought about the things that I care about and the opportunity to actually represent a community that I love. I've said for years that we need less career politicians. We need people who don't actually need to be in politics but want to be there to contribute. And yeah, then I guess going up to COP26, you actually see how important leadership on these big issues is and the difference it does make. And talking to people from, you know, different countries saying, we just don't understand what's happening in Australia. This is such an opportunity for you guys. And that, yet you're not only not acting, but you're trying to undermine our efforts to look after our own country. So yeah, after that, I decided to put my hand up and went through the sort of endorsement process for PROACT and was endorsed as the community candidate. I think it surprised me, I think just how energizing I found it. You know, getting out and meeting thousands of Canberrans and groups, and we have such an incredible city, so many interesting people working on interesting problems and doing what they feel like is really meaningful work. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. We had a great little team. We ended up with just over 2,200 volunteers, which just blew me away. You know, the amount of time and effort that people put in to this, many of them for the first time. And that was one of the cool things about it, is, you know, we'd often have these little meetups for new volunteers and you'd go around the circle and they'd say, you know, this is me for the first, getting involved for the first time. I'd say, yeah, me too. This is all new, but this is exciting, and we can hopefully really contribute here.
One last thing before I go to you, Ebony. You seem very relaxed, composed guy, David. A number of people have commented on it to me. How are you like this? Is there music you like to listen to? Is there things you like to read? What is it that keeps you in fine form and relaxed and calm, especially through, you know, such a big thing as a campaign and now being the big surprise packet in the Senate?
You know, one of the things that I was criticised a lot for during the campaign was, you know, how does playing professional sport in any way prepare you or qualify you to run for politics? One, I was involved in a whole bunch of other stuff outside of professional sport, but I think there are a number of things that does actually prepare you for. A big part of it is work, obviously working in a team, driving what's best for the team as a leader, being able to work with people that you don't necessarily agree with, but you've got some sort of common goal. I think the other thing is around performing under pressure and, yeah, being able to just kind of roll with it and try and maintain, I don't know, you're cool and, yeah, good, get a good night's sleep when you're under pressure. So, yeah, hopefully I can use all those things should I be a senator for the ACT.
Terrific. Well, Ebony, we better let the audience, I know there's a big one online and they will have been asking lots of questions. I better give them some time. So over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. We've got more than 50 questions here, so we're not going to get through all of them, I'm afraid, but we've got close to 800 people on the line with us with lots of questions. So thank you so much, everyone, for your interest. David, I want to start with this first question from Greg Ebeling, who says, David, will you help end the $11.6 billion in fossil fuel subsidies, and how would you reinvest that money? Could you talk to us a little bit about that level of fossil fuel subsidies and what you think can be done about it?
It's a big one. Certainly not something I think you can just turn off, but we clearly have to reprioritize the way that we spend money in Australia. Mm. You know, this was the first budget, this recent budget was, I guess, the first one that I've been really more engaged in and interested in. And for me, the budget is about what you're prioritizing as a nation. You're signaling the direction you want to go, the problems you want to solve. And clearly where we are with climate, spending almost $12 billion subsidizing fossil fuels. Fossil fuels have been great for us in the past. You know, we shouldn't demonize them or the people who've worked in the fossil fuel industries. They're clearly not the future. So this is something that we're going to have to face up to and really work hard to ensure that people in regional areas are looked after, that we're investing in those areas, that renewable projects are going, that the industries of the future, like green steel, that we're actually doing the research and development to begin to become leaders in that field. Mm. I think Sweden are already shipping green steel.
Mm.
That should be us.
Mm. Do you think fossil fuel, sorry, I'm going to do a little follow-up here. Do you think fossil fuel subsidies and, as you said, not potentially ending them overnight, but doing something about them is something that might unite the teal crossbench and the Greens, and that's something that everybody could agree to pursue the new government on?
You'd hope so. I mean, that's a lot of money that you could be investing in electrifying households or building industries for the future that will create far more jobs.
Hmm.
You know, that's been one of the great marketing wins of the fossil fuel industry, is inflating in people's minds just how many people are employed in that industry. We have to be investing in other areas. And as I said, you know, Saul Griffiths' modelling suggests $12 billion over 5 years to electrify every household in Australia, unlocking billions and billions of dollars of savings. Much of that will then be spent locally. In Canberra alone, we spend $950 million every year on fuel and energy, and the vast majority of that is on foreign oil. And we're seeing at the moment, you know, petrol back up above $2 a litre. Mm. This is really hurting people.
Mm. The next question I've got, I think, follows on a little bit. It's from Wendy Farmer, who is joining us from the Latrobe Valley, and says, while we've seen the previous government's love of coal and adding confusion in the energy market, she asks, if you're in parliament, how would you make sure that the new government supports coal communities through this transition while we take action on climate change?
Yeah, it was very clear consulting with people across the ACT. People want an orderly transition. It's what we've been missing, is a big picture plan and policies that actually do this, that invest in areas that have had a number of people involved in coal and gas for a long time now. The reality is this is starting to happen. You look at the Hunter Renewal Project, communities are aware that the end of fossil fuels is coming. And so it's really important that we are assisting communities to do that, to plan. And, you know, for a lot of those communities, it may be that if you're a coal miner, you may retire as a coal miner, but your kids won't be coal miners. There'll be other industries for them. And, you know, having spoken to a few people who have gone from the coal industry are now working in renewables, say at wind farms, they've loved the transition. It's been better for them and their families. They can live locally. They've got a well-paid, secure job. So we have to ensure that this is done in an orderly way and in a way that actually benefits these regional areas.
I've got a couple of questions in here about coal and gas developments and mining, but given your involvement in agriculture, and I know in the past being involved in helping farmers in particular protect their land from fossil fuel developments that are inappropriate, wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about your activism in that space and how important, not just for coal communities, but also farming communities, it is to tackle new gas and coal projects that aren't needed or aren't welcome in certain places.
Yeah, much was made during the campaign about my involvement in a protest with a fifth generation farmer, Rick Laird, in Moules Creek, end of 2014, protesting a coal mine on some of our best agricultural land in Australia, the Liverpool Plains. Makes no sense that we would be setting up fossil fuel projects on our best agricultural land in Australia. And I think we have to be standing up for farmers more. I think in the Australian psyche, we like to talk about farmers and think that we're looking out for them, but I think the reality is we aren't. And it's been really disappointing to see the Nationals' policy and sort of agitation when it comes to climate, given that the government's own figures show that the average farmer in Australia has missed out on 22%, or their profits come down 22% every year since the year 2000, which is huge for farmers. So this is clearly something that we have to act on, and I think we have to re-look at the way that the EPBC Act is dealing with these sorts of developments. You know, the Samuel review showed that the EPBC Act is not fit for purpose anymore. It's not actually working to safeguard our biodiversity.
Sorry, I have a quick follow-up there. You've got something you think that new Labor Environment Minister, whoever they are, should be doing in that environmental protection and biodiversity space?
I mean, we've seen the State of the Environment report. I think it was delivered in December, due to come out in January. We still haven't seen that. Mm-hmm. So I think releasing the report, and, you know, Australians want to look after our wildlife, and it should be more of a priority. We're grossly underspending in that area, and we're seeing, you know, just last year, 37 new species were upgraded on the threatened species list. For a country like Australia, that's not good enough. Mm. We can and should be doing more in that area.
I've got a kind of follow-up question. The Australia Institute has done a lot of research on the impacts of putting a moratorium on new coal mines, showing it would have a negligible effect on our economy, and really arguing that there's no place to open new coal mines. And we've joined with Pacific Islands in backing a global moratorium on new coal mines in particular. But I've got a question here from John Knox, who says, are you likely to take a similar stance to the Greens on no new coal and gas mines or projects? Could you talk to us a little bit about the role of new projects and how you would approach that in the Senate?
Sure. I've said during the campaign, we need a pragmatic way forward on climate. For me, that looks like Zali Steggall's climate bill, actually legislating 60% by 2030, creating a plan to get there. I'm not sure if the way to do that is to actually go with a moratorium. I think actually having the targets and moving Australia forward in terms of electrification, in terms of investing in renewables and in investing in the regions, I think the result could be very similar without having to go through more sort of climate wars and everything that has. It's been so damaging for Australia.
The next question I've got here is from Robin Gardner, who asks, will you actively support Helen Haynes' proposed ICAC model with truth in advertising, proper funding, et cetera, if we can move to that issue of integrity?
Yeah, very, very quickly. Yes, during the campaign, I backed Helen Haynes' bill. It was a huge process of consultation. It's been lauded as the gold standard. when it comes to an integrity commission. Labor have come out and said that they will prioritize it. They've said hopefully by December. So I would hope that they will back Helen's bill. We'll wait and see, you know, should they have to go through the whole consultation and redrafting process, that could really delay things.
The next question I've got is from Gordon Churchman, who asks, will you work towards an end to the cruel refugee stance of the big parties, and will genuine refugees be able to come and stay in Australia?
This was something that came up a lot during the campaign. My sense is that people in Canberra want a more compassionate approach. What we're doing at the moment is cruel, and it's also incredibly expensive. We have to find a better way of dealing with refugees. Having said that, we can't go back to the madness we saw in the 2010s with boat arrivals and, you know, both sides of politics doing what they were doing. So it's a really big one. It's going to be a challenge, but would certainly, you know, support a more pragmatic way to actually deal with this issue and to ensure that people who are genuine refugees in Australia can contribute and they're not being held in limbo for, you know, years and years.
I've got a couple of people in here kind of commenting on the actual election results and the shift away from the major parties. John Neave is asking how damaging the two-party system has been for creating the situation we are now in. But David, I just wondered if you could reflect on that kind of big shift from voters away from the major parties, and if you see that as something that's kind of here to stay, and in your experiences with voters, you know, out on the hustings, what was the feedback that you were getting from people? And then Ben, I might get you to kind of give us a big picture on the results after that. But David, what was the feedback from people on the ground?
Yeah, I'm certainly no political expert. Talking to people, I think there were a few things. A frustration about being taken for granted as such a safe, you know, an area of safe seats here in the ACT. Frustration around the politicisation of issues like climate, where people just want government to get on with the way forward and actually dealing with it. But then I think also seeing what independents around the country have been able to do to actually represent their communities on issues that are important to them. And for example, in the last Senate, Senator Patrick, the work he was doing around freedom of information and integrity, Jackie Lambie really going into Batford, Tasmania, having their social housing debt wiped, you know, almost single-handedly getting a Royal Commission into Veteran Suicides. Despite what the major parties say, independents can actually get things done, and there's clearly going to be a really important role for independents going forward. And I think it's a great wake-up call for the major parties to reconnect with the people that they are actually in there to represent. One of the other things which I think ties into it and finally, this election became an issue was money in politics and political donation reform. I think it's something that should be on the agenda. We should be looking at more transparency around political donations, potentially looking at caps, because it's clearly corrosive and Australians know it now. They know that it's having an influence and, you know, politicians are making decisions that aren't actually in the best interests of everyday Australians.
Mm. Ben, I wonder if I might just come to you. I know we've been very focused on the ACT and the Senate in particular, but as I kind of talked about it right at the beginning, this is a bit of a bombshell election result on a number of fronts. How much is this shift or the shifts that we saw on Saturday night going to change politics in general moving forward, do you think?
Well, I think David's win in the ACT is emblematic of something bigger that happened across Australia, and David's part of that. He's led it. He's been involved in it. There are some things that are specific to the ACT, why it happened here, but there are also some themes it's feeding into nationally, and I do think this is the most transformative election in Australia since 1972, Labor's win in the House of Representatives is narrow in the sense of they're only just going to get to 76 seats probably. But while they didn't win in a landslide, the coalition lost in a landslide, and it's going to be reduced to the smallest number of seats proportionally in they've had in the House of Representatives since the Second World War. And that underscores what a big shift has happened. David's right. The trend away from the major parties was exacerbated this election. The coalition Labor Party vote combined will be less than 70%. It was 75% at the last election, and there's been a long-term decline, partly as part of a global trend that's seeing a realignment of politics. And in a way, I think this is election where you saw the dam burst in a number of ways, not just the success of the independents and not just the success of the Greens, but Labor won a whole lot of seats too that you wouldn't normally expect them to win. Seats like Higgins in Melbourne, a seat that has been held by former prime ministers and former treasurers, Labor was able to win it, whereas an independent won Kooyong and David Pocock's won here in the ACT. So it's an election that has really changed the makeup of politics. Now, actually, the physical makeup of the parliament's going to be changed. And I think if you imagine sitting in the Senate or in the House of Representatives as a prime minister and opposition leader and looking across the chamber, you won't just be looking at your opponent, you'll be looking at a kind of new reality. Across both houses of parliament, there's likely to be about 35 crossbenches in total. If you add them all up, that's a sizable change in the chamber. And I think it's going to lead to a sizable change in the debate. On climate change, we've so long been talking about why we can't take action. And I think the debate really moves now into how we can take faster action. That's just one example. And I think we're going to see a very transformed debate. That's not to say all our problems are going to be solved quickly and easily. There's going to be plenty of disappointments, but it is a transformative election that's going to change debates in all sorts of ways we haven't quite expected. And clearly David's a big part of that.
David, I'm going to exercise my prerogative as host and ask a question myself. We've seen a lot of the community independents running as professional women standing, but also raising that issue of gender equality. We've seen some appalling behaviour in Parliament that's kind of, I think, yet to be addressed. And I just feel like in your sporting career, you've been a very powerful advocate against homophobia and racism. How will you tackle promoting gender equality while you're in the Senate?
This was one of the criticisms, was that I'm not a woman running for this seat. The Senate is fortunately one of the areas that we do have equal representation. There's so much to do in this area. I think we're seeing finally more of a spotlight on it, but it's going to take more leadership. But I think it's also about challenging some of the societal norms. And I think that takes men actually standing up and saying, this shouldn't be thought of as a women's issue. This is also a men's issue. And we've got to change the way that we behave. We've got to be calling out behavior in our workplaces, in our families, and really, yeah, trying to change the way that we treat women around us. And yeah, I think there is an expectation that over the next parliament, this will be an issue that is addressed, given what we saw in the last parliament.
Yeah, Eb, just to interrupt with a quick stat for you there, leading on something David said, the Senate now is going to probably track for 57% women, and the House is going to move up from its current 29% to 37.1. So, yeah, clearly the Senate's doing a lot better. And I know our colleague here in the Democracy and Accountability Program, Bill Brown, has pointed to proportional representation as being one of the key drivers that has meant the Senate is now a clear majority of women.
And we don't have much time left, but I'm just interested in kind of how you approach those conversations, because I feel like in particular the way you've challenged homophobia while you were in professional sport, I feel like those are maybe conversations that people are reluctant to have, and it's really about changing a culture there. How did you approach that when you encountered that kind of thing and standing up for, you know, other members of your team or other things? How is it that you have had those conversations in the past in perhaps sometimes spaces where people don't really want to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, cultural change is uncomfortable. It requires a lot of us to actually get out of our comfort zone and have those conversations that we'd rather not have. But I think at the end of the day, it is a lot about education and challenging things that we just pick up when we're kids from our parents, from our culture, and having honest conversations about why it's detrimental, how we can actually move beyond it. There's no easy fixes to this. I guess my approach in rugby around homophobia was, my feeling was, it shouldn't be up to a teammate that I had that may be gay to actually advocate. It's up to all of us to create the kind of inclusive environment where people can be who they are, contribute, express themselves, and we all benefit from that.
Thank you so much. We've only got a couple of minutes to go, so we'll have to wrap it up there. I'm really sorry that we couldn't get to everyone's questions. There were some fantastic ones in there. Thank you so much, everyone in the chat, for an excellent discussion as well. And of course, thank you to Ben Oakquist and David Pocock, Independent Senate candidate for the ACT and likely to secure that second Senate spot as soon as we can finish counting those Senate votes and preferences. Thank you so much for your time today, David. I know it must have been a very flat out campaign and still a bit of a ways before you might be able to claim victory, but we really appreciate your time today.
No, thanks, Ebony. Great to be here.
Thanks, David. Lovely.
This has been a special webinar episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are completely free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel at australiainstitute.tv. All our latest research and content is at australiainstitute.org.au. And we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. This episode was produced by me, Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks so much for listening.